Brooklyn Age of Radio Theater, the story of the Count of Monte Cristo. Actually, what we're going to do is bring you two episodes from the Playhouse of Favorites series concerning the Count of Monte Cristo. The first half hour was originally released as The Escape, and the second half hour, The Revenge. We're going to bring them together at the same time in case someone couldn't listen next time we're on the air. So we bring you now from a syndicated series entitled The Playhouse of Favorites, the story of the Count of Monte Cristo.
From its place on the shelf of immortal romantic classics, we take down the Count of Monte Cristo and raise the curtain on a story of treachery so great that it plants the seed of a terrible revenge. ...1815 was the year when Louis XVIII sat on the throne of France. But his seat was uneasy, for on the island of Elba, the little corporal, Napoleon Bonaparte, was already plotting a triumphant return, and France bubbled and seethed with intrigue and counter-intrigue like a witch's brew, as the man on Elba watched and waited and dreamed of new glory. It was in January of this year that the good ship Pharaon set out from Naples, bound for Marseille, and aboard her was Edmond Dantès, first mate. The vessel had been out but a few days when the master, Captain Leclerc, was struck down with a paralyzing attack of brain fever. He fought it valiantly, but his battle was a losing one. And finally, he sent for Edmond Dantès to attend him in his cabin.
Dantès, it is the end. You, as first mate, must take my command and bring my ship to port.
Yes.
And there is something else, Dantès. A mission you must perform for me. You swear that you will do it?
I swear it, Captain.
In my sea trunk, you will find a packet of documents. You must stop the vessel at Elba and deliver them to the Emperor Napoleon's Grand Marshal.
The Bonaparte's Marshal, sir? But
you will do it, Dantès. You will stop at Elba. Remember, you have sworn?
Yes, Captain, I will do it.
Good. Now, you trust me, my boy. No harm shall come to you of this. Nothing but honor.
Captain. Captain Leclerc. Edmond Dantès stopped the vessel at Porto Ferrajo, off the island of Elba, and carried out Captain Leclerc's mysterious mission. He delivered the packet to Napoleon's marshal, and that officer gave him a sealed letter to deliver to a certain Monsieur Noirtier in Paris. The Pharaon had just set sail for Marseille again when the young captain was approached on the deck by D'Anglaire, the shipowner's agent.
What authority, Dantès, did you stop this vessel at Elba?
By the authority of Captain Leclerc, Monsieur D'Anglaire.
You caused us to lose a day and a half on the voyage. You understand that this is a serious matter, and I must report it to the owners. I shall recommend a change. That is, unless you disclose what was in that packet you took ashore at Elba.
Oh, you know about the packet?
Yes.
How?
My business to know everything that goes on aboard this ship. Perhaps you do not realize what you've done, my dear Dantès. Napoleon waits on Elba, and any mariner who stops there on the most harmless purpose is open to suspicion, even if he never steps ashore. But when you deliver a packet in the dead of night, well, it's a dangerous traffic, and it's very dangerous.
I know nothing about that. I'm not a politician, but a sailor. Now, if you leave the deck,
you have the impudence to order me from this deck?
I would order the devil himself to go below if he were in my way as you are. Now, will you leave my deck, monsieur?
Very well, Captain Dantès, but mark my words. You will regret this.
D'Anglaire did everything in his power to depose Dantès, but the owners stood firm. They liked the young man and thought highly of his seamanship and kept him on as captain. This was one cause of joy for the young man, but there was another, a beautiful Catalan girl named Mercedes, who had promised to marry him when this voyage was done. But during the time that he'd been in Naples, a cousin of Mercedes, one Fernand, had been busy. He wanted the Catalan girl, desperately.
For the 100th time, Mercedes, I ask you to marry me.
And for the 100th time, Fernand, I refuse.
Oh, this Dantès, this Edmond Dantès.
I love him, Fernand, with all my heart. And no other man will ever be my husband.
There's no other living man you would marry then?
No other.
But suppose he were dead, this Dantes. What then?
Then I should die too.
Oh, you're not serious.
Listen to me, Fernand. If anything should happen to Edmond Dantes, believe me, I would climb to the highest point of the Cape de Morgion and throw myself headlong from it.
Mercedes, no. No, you wouldn't. If Dantes died, I would take care of you. I would make you forgetful of my love. I would make you happy.
Mercedes!
Who's that?
It's Edmond. He's back.
Mercedes.
Oh, Edmond.
You've no idea how hungry to hold you in my arms again. Feel the lips on mine again. Oh. Who's this gentleman?
Oh, a friend of mine, Edmund. More than a friend. My cousin, Fernand.
Indeed, I'm delighted. Of course, you'll come to our wedding, monsieur. Meanwhile, I regard you as my warm friend.
Friend? I'm no friend of yours, Dantes. And I'll see you rot before I shake your hand.
What?
Fernand, wait, come back.
I'll never give you up. Do you hear, Mercedes? I'll never give you up.
Felt young Edmond Dantes, liked and respected by everybody else, now had two implacable enemies, the shrewd Danglars and the fiery Fernand. And it was not long before Danglars and Fernand met and found a community of interest in their hatred for the young sea captain. And so it happened that one day the two sat on the terrace of a cafe.
More wine, Fernand?
Yes. Yes, more wine. More wine.
Suppose our friend Dantes was sent to prison.
To prison?
Yes. For a long, long time.
Yes, but how? How? Dantes has done nothing.
Oh, you are wrong, my friend. I happen to know that he's a Bonapartist agent.
In the pay of Napoleon?
Without a doubt. I know the fact and circumstance. I know that at this moment he has a letter which he must deliver to a secret emissary in Paris. He doesn't know I know about the letter.
What? What can we do then, Danglars? Tell me. What can we do?
Ah, patience, my friend. I'll show you. Garçon.
Yes, monsieur.
Bring pen and ink and paper, quick.
At once, monsieur.
Now then. I will write a letter to the king's agent concerning Dante's treachery. Of course, I won't sign it. However, we may need someone to come forward and vouch for the letter in case the king's agent demands proof.
Oh, I'll come forward. I'll denounce him myself.
Good, good. Now, Fernand, you'll really have your revenge.
Your paper and ink, monsieur.
Very well. Now note, Fernand, I will write the denunciation with my left hand so that the writing will not be recognized. Let us begin.
The web of treachery began to spin itself about Edmond Dantes. And that young man, oblivious to the plotting of hate-poisoned minds, danced at his betrothal feast with the lovely Mercedes.
Are you happy, my darling?
Happy? Oh, Edmond, I'm happier than any woman has a right to be. Except for one thing. You're going to Paris tomorrow.
Oh, yes, but I shall be back in 3 days. Think only of a week from now, when we shall be man and wife. 7 days, my darling.
It's an eternity. Edmund, tell me, why must you go to Paris?
Oh, to deliver a letter. Oh, but come, this is our betrothal feast. Let us dance around and around, faster and faster.
Open this door to the king's men.
I'll go.
I seek one Edmond Dantes here. Where is he?
Why, I am Edmond Dantes, Sergeant.
Then I arrest you in the name of King Louis.
And so it was that Edmond Dantes was questioned by the king's deputy, Monsieur de Villefort, of whom it was said that no man could be more loyal to his majesty. De Villefort listened to Dantes' impassioned story gravely, studied the young man's honest face, and then smiled.
Monsieur Dantes, I am convinced that you tell a straight story. A man of your years could not be engaged in this kind of intrigue. It is hardly possible.
Then you believe I'm innocent?
Without a doubt.
Thank you, Monsieur de Villefort. I'm eternally grateful for your trust.
Not at all, my friend. You may now go back to your bride-to-be. You are a free man.
Again, my thanks, monsieur. I shall never forget what you have done.
Oh, Monsieur Dantès.
Yes?
You have this letter?
Yes, here in my pocket.
To whom is it addressed?
A man named Noirtier at Rue Coqueron.
Noirtier? Did you say Noirtier?
Yes.
Give me the letter. Let me see it.
But of course. Here it is. What is it, Monsieur de Villefort? Your face grows dark. Will it make a change? Do you intend to hold me now?
My plans are changed. I will detain you, but overnight. Then you'll be free to go.
The next morning, Edmond Dantès was released. He was gratified to find that de Villefort had ordered a coach to bring him back to Mercedes, complete with military guards. However, he had no sooner entered the coach than he was overpowered by the guard. Later, they took him on a boat, headed for the gray, grim, forbidding prison of Chateau d'If in the harbor of Marseille. And now began a new phase in the life of Edmond Dantès, later to be known as the Count of Monte Cristo.
I demand to know why I've been brought here.
Silence. I do not know. I simply have orders to place you in a dungeon. That is my duty. Now observe silence.
I've been betrayed by friends, I tell you. I've not been given a chance to speak in my own defense. I demand a hearing. I demand it.
Hello? Enter.
What did I tell you?
Get into that dungeon, do you hear?
Open this door, guard. Open it. Let me free. I'm innocent. I swear it. I'm innocent. I've been betrayed. Betrayed.
Alas for Edmond Dantès. He lost even his name and became only a number, number 34. The days passed into months, and the months into years. Years in which the dark, cold dungeon became his only home, and the curt voice of the jailer, the only human voice he heard.
Your dinner, number 34.
Guard. Guard, I beg of you. I plead with you. Take this letter to Monsieur Maximilien Morel in Marseille. He will pay you well.
What? And implicate myself with the Bonapartists? Do you take me for a fool?
I am not a Bonapartist. I am loyal to the king, I swear it. I'm innocent, innocent.
They all say that, number 34. Take that old man in the next cell to yours, number 27. He's stark, raving mad, like the rest of you. He's offered me buried treasure worth 13 million livres if I help him escape. 13 million livres in gold and jewels. And he knows where it is. Why should I take a pittance from you when the old man in the next cell can reward me so handsomely?
I swear I'm innocent.
You've been swearing the same thing for 4 years, number 34. Don't you ever get tired of it? Why don't you imagine some buried treasure, too, and start to count it? It'll help pass the time.
Is there no one? No one who can help me? Is there no one who can find me, who can hear my voice? 4 years in this cold, dark cage. 4 years. Betrayed and forgotten. What's that? A sound. From inside the wall. Through a rock beating against the wall. Yes, I can hear it plainly. I must answer it with my fist. I'll be hit against the wall. Answer it. He has heard. An answer. The hammering has stopped. It's...
Number 34. Number 34.
Yes, it is I, number 34. Who are you?
Number 27. I am in the wall chiseling out a tunnel. Can you hear me plainly now?
Yes, I can hear you, number 27.
I meant this tunnel to lead to the outside wall from where I might drop into the harbor and escape. But I miscalculated.
How have you formed this tunnel?
By fashioning tools out of the furniture in my cell.
It's hard for me to believe. It's almost incredible. Yours, 27, is the first human voice I have heard outside of the guards for 4 years.
And yours, The first I have heard in 9 years.
Who are you? Why are you here? Tell me.
Patience, my friend. Later. This is a time for work, not talk. Soon I will loosen one of the stones in your cell and come in to face you. Meanwhile, look out for the guard while I toil to chisel away these last few inches of stone.
The time came at last. The stone loosened, and Dantes eagerly removed it. An old man wriggled through the passageway. Then the two forgotten men, number 34 and number 27, faced each other, tears streaming down their eyes, and embraced without a word. The old man was Abbe Faria, an Italian political prisoner, also condemned without trial. Each day they met by means of a tunnel passageway and confided each to each their innermost thoughts. Abbe Faria was a learned scholar and taught Dantes everything he knew of the arts and sciences and language. He was also a man of the world and wise in the ways of men. And after hearing Dante's story, the betrayal of his young friend became an open book.
You saw the unsigned letter denouncing you, eh, Edmund?
Yes, the Villefort showed it to me.
And while Danglars' handwriting was smooth and flowing, this letter was written in clumsy fashion.
Yes.
An obvious trick, my son. And a common one. Danglars had only to write it with his left hand. Fernand, of course, was working with him. He had a good motive to be rid of you, namely Mercedes. And you say you saw them together often, with their heads very close.
Yes, Abbe. There's no doubt in my mind that those two betrayed me. There's only one thing that's not clear to me now.
And what is that, Edmund?
The action of the Villefort. He had promised to set me free. Yet, as soon as he saw the letter I was carrying, He deceived me, abducted me, and had me imprisoned here.
To whom was the letter addressed? Perhaps that would give us a clue, since you do not know what was in it.
Why, to Monsieur Noirtier.
Did you say Monsieur Noirtier?
Yes. But, Abbe Faria, why do you look at me so?
He happens to be de Villefort's father.
De Villefort's father?
Yes. And now the gentleman's motive in burying you here at Chateau d'If is plain. If it ever became known that his own father was dealing with a Bonapartist, de Villefort would lose both his influence and position.
Donc la Fernand and de Villefort. If I ever breathe the air of freedom again, see the light of day, these three I shall hound to the end of the earth and exact my revenge.
The years passed. The two men spent every hour they could together while the guard was away and plotted to escape. They began a tunnel then in the 14th year of Edmond Dantes' imprisonment. Furiously they worked day and night, and then, when they were halfway to success, Abbe Faria had a stroke that left him dying.
Edmund. Edmund, my son.
Abbe, we will wait till you recover. Then we'll make our escape together.
Listen, my son. Time grows short. My strength ebbs. There is a better way than this tunnel now. When I die, they will place me in a burial sack and throw me over the wall into the harbor. You follow me?
Yes. Yes, Abbe.
They will leave me in the cell for a while, lying in the sack until disposal papers are made out. Then you will crawl into my cell here, cut open the sack, take my body out and drag it into your cell. You follow me thus far, Edmund?
I do.
The rest is simple. You will enter the sack and sew yourself in with the tools I have given you. Thus, you will substitute yourself for my corpse. Once underwater, you can cut your way out of the sack with your knife and thus escape. Will be dangerous, but You will have a chance for freedom. Is it clear, my son?
Yes, Abbe, it is clear.
Good. Now, attend me. You have a mission in life.
Yes. Revenge upon those who betrayed me.
You will need money. I know where there is a great treasure buried. It is too long a story now. But hear this. There are 13 million livres buried on the Isle of Monte Cristo.
Monte Cristo?
Yes, in a certain grotto there. Listen now and commit to memory these instructions. Lean your ear close to my mouth. Beloved son, my time is short and my voice fails.
Many months later, a small vessel hove to off a tiny island called Monte Cristo. And at the bow, a man stood, his eyes burning with a strange, vengeful fire, his lips moving.
Now I'm free. Soon I will be rich, but it will not be enough. Revenge upon the three who betrayed me. Danglars, Fernand de Villefort. For the treasures of Monte Cristo, the world is mine.
Edmond Dantès disappeared, and his name was forgotten. But as the years passed, a name came to be whispered with awe all over the continent. The name of the Count of Monte Cristo. Here was a nobleman of fabulous wealth, of dark mystery, a citizen of the world claiming allegiance to no one place. Here was a man whom great ladies adored from afar, whom princes and potentates respected, and before whom the wealthiest bankers bowed. Yet none could pierce the mysterious shroud of his background, not even Ide, the beautiful Greek girl whom he purchased as a slave in the marketplace. And now the year is 1838, and the place is Monte Cristo's palace in Naples.
May I speak, Master?
Huh? Oh, what is it, Heidi?
Your emissary to Paris has just arrived and awaits an audience.
Oh, good. Bid him enter.
Your wish is my life, Master.
Greetings, Master.
Ah, Guido. You come from Paris. You've completed your mission?
Yes, as you directed. I have investigated all three of the gentlemen.
Then speak.
With which shall I begin?
With De Villefort.
He is now the king's attorney for all of Paris, and high in the favor of the court.
And the details of his private life?
I investigated thoroughly, Master. They are above reproach. All except one. Look upon these documents.
Excellent. Who knows? Perhaps these may lead us to the Achilles heel of our friend, the king's attorney. Now, what of the ship's agent, Danglars?
He has risen high, Master. He is now a millionaire banker in Paris with the title of Baron.
Ah? And the fisherman, Fernand?
He won a fortune in the Greek War of Independence. Now he lives in Paris and boasts of a title, the Comte de Mercer. And, of course, there is the lovely Countess Mercedes de Mercer and her son, Albert.
Did you say her name was Mercedes, Guido?
Why, yes.
Mercedes. So that villain did steal you from me while I languished in prison. You have done well, Guido. Now leave me and bid Ide enter.
At once, Master.
De Villefort. Baron Danglars. Count of Morcerf. It's a long time since we have met. A long, long time.
You summon me, Master?
Yes. Prepare my entourage for a journey. We leave tomorrow night.
And where shall we journey, Master?
To Paris. We journey to Paris.
Let us now enter the palatial drawing room of Baron Danglars. Some weeks have elapsed. The Baron is pacing around expectantly, and his aristocratic wife, the Baroness, watches him silently as the Count of Monte Cristo enters.
Baron Danglars?
Yes. This is my wife, the Baroness.
Charmed, madame.
charmed indeed.
Now I understand.
Understand what, Countess?
Why the ladies of Paris find you so interesting.
Oh, thank you. But I'm new here and therefore of some curiosity. When they really discover me, they will shun me like the plague.
Shall we get down to business, Count?
Oh, by all means, Baron. My business is very brief. You are a banker, and since I expect to be in Paris for a time, I shall require unlimited credit. Of course, you've already received a letter of advice on me from Thompson and French in Rome.
Yes, a very good banking house and highly solvent. Naturally, I should be very happy to represent you in Paris, Count.
Good.
However, you ask for unlimited credit. Just what does that mean?
Just what it implies. Unlimited.
Say, £1,000,000?
A million? My dear Baron, you jest. This sum is a mere trifle. I shall require 5 or 6 at the very least.
5 or 6 million?
But of course, £1,000,000. Why, my dear Baron, I'm in the habit of carrying that sum in my purse. See, look for yourself.
Come, Henri. You do not usually delay this long.
No, but 5 or 6 million, it's fantastic.
Is it? Then perhaps I had better open an account somewhere else.
Oh, no, Count. Stay. I should be very glad to accommodate you.
Good. I'm glad that we have come to terms.
The Count of Monte Cristo ingratiated himself into the Danglars household. Soon he was intimate with the financial affairs of the Baron, and particularly his dealing in Spanish stocks. And then came a day when the Count paid a visit to the telegraph signal office in the suburbs of Paris, which served all the capital. Here, through a system of semaphores, looking like windmills which are separated on high points, miles apart, news signals could be transmitted with great speed. And the Count was deeply interested in this signaling procedure, but more so in the operator.
There. You see, monsieur, I have signaled a message. It will be caught up at each semaphore station and thus relayed to the Ministry of the Interior in Paris. From there, the information goes directly to the bourse.
Fascinating pursuit indeed. Tell me, my man, what do they pay you for this important work?
1,000 francs a year.
Only 1,000? It's a paltry sum.
True. Barely enough on which to live. However, I am entitled to a pension of 500 francs a year when I retire.
Do you think you could retire on 15,000 francs?
15,000? Oh, monsieur, you jest.
On the contrary. I have a message I want you to transmit to Paris in place of this regular Spanish financial communication. I'm willing to pay you 25,000 francs.
25,000 francs? Sacrebleu. You have the money here?
In my purse. Here.
Very well, monsieur, very well. It is a bargain. Give me your message.
Shortly thereafter, a trusted messenger in the employ of Baron Danglars leaped from his horse, entered the Baron's house, asked for an immediate audience with the banker.
Well, Debray, what is it? Seems to have been in some hurry.
Yes, Baron, and with good reason. I've just come from the Ministry of Interior. There has been terrible news over the telegraph.
Well, what is it? Speak up, man.
The king has returned to Spain, and even now there's a revolution in Barcelona.
Revolution in Barcelona? Oh, you must be wrong, Debray. I've millions in Spanish shares. Millions, I tell you. They'll be worthless now.
Yes, sell them, Baron. Sell them at any cost before the news reaches the bourse, otherwise...
Yes. Yes, go to the bourse at once. Quick, man. Instruct my agent there to unload every share of Spanish stock I own.
Danglars managed to get rid of his stock at great sacrifice. And despite the fact that he lost hundreds of thousands of francs on the transaction, he could not help boasting of a triumph, at least before the Baroness.
Yes. Yes, my dear. The shares were worthless, absolutely worthless. Of course, I had advance information to that effect.
And you sold them knowing this?
Naturally. Business is business. And do you know the fellow who was stupid enough to buy this worthless paper, my dear?
Well, who?
None other than your friend, the Count of Monte Cristo.
I don't believe it.
I tell you the fact, madame. Now, perhaps you will admit that your husband is clever. At least in some respects.
Baron Danglars.
Debray, what the devil do you mean coming in here without being announced?
The telegraph report, it was false. Do you understand, Baron? There was a mistake. The fog, the operator took the message wrong.
What?
Yes, I've just come from the Bourse. The King of Spain is still in exile. The Spanish shares you sold to the Count of Monte Cristo have risen to the sky on the wave of a new confidence. They're worth a fortune now. And the Count of Monte Cristo owns them all.
And so it went. Everything that Danglars touched turned not to gold but dross. And somehow the Count of Monte Cristo was always near. And finally, in desperate financial circumstances, Baron Danglars stole 5 million francs of the Paris hospital fund, of which he was the banker, and fled to Italy. But here he was kidnapped by a bandit chief who took his orders from a mysterious man in hood and cloak. For weeks he was kept in a cavern hideout. Then, finally, after Danglars was relieved of his stolen gains, he was confronted by his tormentor in the gloom of the cavern.
Well, Baron, it is the end at last. You go forth for your punishment, and never was it more richly deserved.
Who are you? What is that face behind the hood?
I shall remove it, Baron, and you shall look hard and long.
Why, the Count of Monte Cristo. But why have you hounded? Why have you pursued me here? Why have you ruined
look
me?
Look well upon my face, Danglars. Look hard and well. This face was young once. The face of youth with sublime faith in the goodness of mankind. 14 years in the dungeon of Chateau d'If changed all that.
No, it cannot be.
But it can, and it is.
Then you are Edmond Dantès?
Yes, Danglars. I am Edmond Dantès, returned from the grave for revenge. You were the first to feel my avenging wrath. But there are two others who must suffer before I can rest again.
Yes, Edmond Dantès had tasted the fullness of sweet revenge on his first enemy. For in that moment of terrible revelation, the hair on Danglars' head turned white. He went forth into the world broken, penniless, hunted, never to be heard of again.
Already avenged himself on Baron Danglars by ruining him financially, sending him out into the world a changed man, old, broken. Now he has a score to settle with the remaining two conspirators, de Villefort and the Count de Morcerf, who long ago sent him to prison, an innocent man. But on with the story. Paris, and all Europe for that matter, was still abuzz with the ruin and disappearance of Baron Danglars. But in the king's court, de Villefort, the prosecutor, was unruffled. His business was to send criminals to the guillotine, and this he did with unflagging zeal. And it so happened that the next poor wretch he was to prosecute was one Benedetto, whom Monte Cristo had hired to pose as a bogus Italian nobleman and pay court to Danglars' daughter. But Benedetto had killed a man in wrath. The day of his trial came, and the courtroom was crowded, for de Villefort was a magnet. No other king's attorney in France was so harsh, so pitiless, so thorough in his persecution. Now he stood at the bench and pointed at the haggard prisoner in the dock, while from a rear seat, a richly dressed nobleman watched with the greatest of interest.
And so, Monsieur le President, this wretch struck and kills. The blood, the sacred blood of a Frenchman spilled and stained the gutter. So, for this evil being, for this wretched monster, I demand what the law of France requires. Retribution. Revenge for the cold and dead. In short, the guillotine.
Order. Order in the court.
The prisoner now has the right to speak in his own defense.
Monsieur le President, the king's attorney has spoken truth. I have been forger, thief, and now assassin. But this career of crime might not have been. Long ago, my father married a simple country girl, then fell in love with another of high estate. I was born of his first wife, but he did not want me. He took me from my mother's arms and buried me in the garden of our house, alive. The foul deed was seen, and I was dug up before I perished. Later, I was placed in an orphanage. Since then, I have wandered the face of the earth, living by my wits, hating him who is my father, body and soul, swearing revenge. Now I found him, and now I accuse him.
Who is this monster, Benedetto?
He is here in the courtroom.
Here in the courtroom?
Name him.
Very well. I will name him. My father, the man who committed this foul deed, is the king's attorney, Monsieur de Villefort. He failed. He staggered with a blow. For justice has come home to roost.
With this stunning revelation, de Villefort saw his whole position, his whole life, come crashing down over his eyes. At last, he went stark, raving mad. And now there was but one betrayer left before the quest of the Count of Monte Cristo was done. And that man was Fernand, the fisherman, now known as the Count de Morcerf. Shortly afterward, notices began to appear in the Parisian papers, hinting that Fernand Mondego had indeed treacherously sold out to Turkey and thus made his fortune. He denied it in the Chamber of Peers, but a surprised witness appeared with indisputable proof. And the Count de Morcerf was judged guilty of felony, treason, and outrage. Then the next day, a young man sought an audience with the Count.
You are the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes.
My name is Albert de Morcerf. I am the son of a man wrongly accused of treason by the Chamber of Peers.
I understood the evidence was fairly complete.
It was you who placed those notices in the newspapers. You are responsible for his misfortune.
Well?
Here, Monsieur le Comte. Here's my glove across your face. I will meet you anywhere, any time, and with any weapons.
Very well, my young friend. I have received your glove. But you will get it back. Only there will be a bullet wrapped up in it.
The Count of Monte Cristo was a crack shot and an expert swordsman. He had no doubt of his ability to send young de Morcerf into the hereafter with the greatest of ease, and even relished the idea of doing so. But late that night, he received a caller.
Enter, madame.
Edmund.
Edmund. I know my son Albert fights a duel with you tomorrow. You must stay.
Pardon, Madame de Morcerf. By what name did you call me?
Edmund. I knew you the moment I laid eyes on you.
Madame...
Edmund, I beg of you. It is not Madame de Morcerf who comes to you now. It is Mercedes.
I know of no one by that name now. To me, Madame, Mercedes is dead.
Edmund, how can you say that? I loved you then, and I love you now.
Is this true?
Yes. Yes, I swear.
Yet you married the man who conspired to send me to the dungeon of Chateau d'If for 14 years.
Chateau d'If? 14 years? You mean Fernand sent you? No. No, that cannot be.
Then you did not know?
No. I knew nothing except that you disappeared. I thought you dead. Edmund, Edmund, did you think I would have married Fernand if I knew you still lived?
Yes, did I? If you knew how many times I uttered your name, frozen in the cold, crouched on the straw of my dungeon.
Edmund, do you love me still?
Let me say, I admire you greatly, respect you deeply, and assure you of my warm affection.
Then I beg of you, take revenge on those who were guilty for your misfortunes. But not on the innocent. Not on my son.
Mercedes.
Edmund, you will spare Albert. You will not kill him.
No. I promise you he will live.
Thank God for your nobility, Edmund. And the duel will not go on after all.
On the contrary, it will.
What do you mean?
Must go on. It is a question of honor.
But if you spare Albert and...
Then, instead of your son's blood staining the ground... Mine will flow.
No. No, this must not happen. I love you both. And there must be a way to save you both from your madness. There must be a way. And I shall find it.
The next day at dawn, the Count of Monte Cristo waited in a forest outside of Paris. He fully expected this day to be his last. He had promised Mercedes to spare her son. He would steel himself to aim his pistol wildly or thrust his sword in thin air while Albert struck a mortal blow home.
For what is a duel but kill or be killed? And since he could not kill, then he must die. As the Count reflected this, a carriage approached rapidly up the forest road. The carriage of Albert de Morcerf.
Master, here comes de Morcerf.
Any second.
So I see.
Count, last night I wanted to kill you. But this morning, I humbly repent. I've been a hasty fool, and I have come not to fight, but to apologize.
Hey, what did you do? I do not understand the Morcerf.
My mother told me everything.
What's this? Told you everything?
Yes. But I say to these gentlemen here that I proclaim it publicly. That which you did against my father was justified. And I, his son, can only thank you for not taking a more severe revenge.
This is a brave deed you have done, de Morcerf. It takes courage to forego a duel once made.
Perhaps. I am prepared to suffer the insinuations of others in a cause such as this. For your courage was greater than mine, Monte Cristo. You were prepared not to resist me, but to die.
With this act of the son, Monte Cristo's feelings of revenge were softened against the father, Fernand, Count de Morcerf. He resolved that at last his mission was done, his revenge complete. But it was not to be, for Count de Morcerf himself stormed into the house of Monte Cristo and faced his enemy.
My son was to fight a duel with you, monsieur. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And he offered you an apology and left the field without raising his sword on my behalf?
Yes. But it was a brave act, not a cowardly one.
Ah, it was the act of a craven. But I am prepared to defend my own honor.
Honor. Honor, that's a strange word coming from you, Fernand.
Oh? You know me from long ago?
Only too well.
So much the better. Will you draw your sword, or must I run you through like a common criminal?
Gladly. And now your blood will run as deep as the tears I wept at Chateau d'If.
What was that you said about Chateau d'If?
14 long years in a lonely dungeon, betrayed by you and two other villains, and left to die unmourned.
No. No, it cannot be. You must be a ghost.
Look upon me well, Fernand, for you face me in this moment before you face your maker.
Edmond Dantes. Edmond Dantes! Edmond Dantes! Return from the grave!
The Count de Morcerf raced from the house. Wildly, he ran out into the street just as a heavy carriage was passing. He was knocked down, and the hoofs of the horses trampled his body. The same evening, he died in delirium, crying the name Edmond, Edmond, Edmond Dantes. And Monte Cristo's revenge was complete. What happened to him after this, nobody knew, for he left Paris and France. But he was not alone, for Aide, the lovely slave girl, was with him. Where were they going? Perhaps to the island of Monte Cristo. Perhaps that is where Edmond Dantes went to spend the rest of his days. Perhaps, but nobody knows, for he was never seen again.
Actually, from two separate episodes of the Playhouse of Favorites, we've presented The Count of Monte Cristo on the Golden Age of Radio Theater.